Hi, and welcome to the Loopcast. Today we're going to talk about the Malaysian airline flight incident of Flight 330. And just for our viewers' info, please note that the views expressed in the show are basically just that. They're going to be views. It is an ongoing investigation, of course, and the fate of Flight 30 is a mystery as we speak. And it is a sensitive subject because there are families waiting for loved ones to come home, waiting for a word for their loved ones. So please keep that in mind. But today I'm very happy to have Herb Carmen on the show. And Herb is a Navy captain, 19 years of flying experience. And he has clocked about 4,100 flight hours. So he has vast experience being an aviator. And he's also flown in the region where Flight 30 went missing. So that's something to keep in mind when we speak to him. And he's also worked as a military fellow for the Center for New American Security. And another disclaimer, just please note that Herb's views during this conversation do not represent the Navy or the DOD. Thank you for coming on the show, Herb.
Hey, thank you for having me, Chelsea.
And maybe for our viewers, I know you have a vast background of experience, so maybe you could give them a little bit more info about your background with aviation.
Okay. Well, I'm an E-2 and C-2 pilot by background, so I've flown large turboprop airplanes, which is it's a multi-crew cockpit. I've been trained as an aviation safety officer, which in the Navy is who conducts safety investigations if there's ever a mishap. I've also served as a flight instructor and taught crew resource management as a flight instructor and was a commanding officer of a squadron in my last flying tour, which ended in 2009, and I've been in Washington since.
Well, thank you for coming on the show again. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to kind of give what I would call a timeline of the events regarding Flight 370. Basically, some of this information, as we know, is changing depending on things that are being discovered within the active investigation. But basically, on March 8th, the flight took off from Kuala Lumpur for Beijing at about 12:41 a.m. with 239 passengers and crew on board. And at about 1:19 a.m., someone inside the cockpit who is believed to be the co-pilot makes a final voice contact with the air traffic control, basically saying, "All right, good night." However, new findings have shown that 12 minutes before this verbal message, the plane's flight path program was changed, which we'll get to in a little bit in the conversation. And then we have at 1:21 a.m., authorities say that the transponder was switched off in the plane, which is another thing we'll talk about because this is becoming a very important aspect of the ongoing investigation. And then we have at 1:30 a.m. a civilian radar, actually all civilian radar is lost from the flight between Malaysia and Vietnam. And now recent investigation is also showing that the aircraft communication addressing and reporting system, otherwise known as ACARS, so A-C-A-R-S, was shut down. The last transmission for this was received at about 1:07 a.m., but it's not known exactly when this transponder was shut down because I guess the next transmission was due around 1:37 a.m. So all this time we have all this going on, and then now new evidence is showing that around 1:28 a.m., Thai military, which this just came out a couple of days, I think it was yesterday, so that was Tuesday the 18th, that Thai military detected an unknown signal, which could possibly be Flight 70, and that it was heading in the opposite direction from Beijing, which is giving more power to the thought that potentially the flight has totally changed its flight path. And then there's differing times here. I can't exactly pinpoint what time, but at 2:15 a.m. or about 2:40 a.m., like I said, there's a discrepancy in the times here. It's saying that Malaysian military picks up the plane radar, the plane via radar over the Strait of Malacca. So if you look at both the Thai and the Malaysian military evidence, they both seem to collaborate with one another that this plane ends up heading in a totally opposite direction from Beijing. And then there's another satellite detection at about 8:11 a.m. And it's basically what is known as a handshake. And of course, this is more than 7 hours after takeoff, which provides us with this vast arc, which spans basically north all the way to Kazakhstan. And it kind of covers about 11 countries. And the arc also goes as far south as the deep Indian Ocean. So that's as much of the timeline as I can give you at this moment. But Herb can kind of tell you more about basic aspects of things that we're looking into. So why don't we start off with looking at the safety investigation into this incident and the set of safety investigation rules that would apply.
Okay, well, let me start by saying that I hope that by the time people hear this, they've found the aircraft.
Very much so. I've definitely got the same thing.
You know, I have tremendous sympathy for the families that are waiting, and as you said, we need to be very respectful for them at that time. And as I talk about this, I want to make sure that I don't add to speculation, although we may talk about some of the different theories. I'm of the mindset, and I think that this is fairly common among investigators, is that I try never to rule anything out, and that I also try not to take any single piece of evidence as ground truth until everything tends to come together at the end. You know, you've mentioned some exact times. Locations, tracks. And there's questions about altitude, timing of different, satellite detections, and I would treat those as single pieces of data. But until you start to pull all that together, it's very difficult. Now, the accident investigation itself is run by the Malaysian government under the International Civil Aviation Authority. Organization's rules, and that's the ICAO is what we've when we hear me say ICAO, I'm talking about the International Civil Aviation Organization. Okay. And under ICAO rules, it's across all the different countries that are part of ICAO, the accident investigation procedures are contained within a document known as Annex 13, and that has the international standards and recommended practices. There's also a manual for the actual investigation side. Then comes with four parts. Talks about organization and planning, procedures and checklists, the actual investigation and reporting. There's even documents on how to provide assistance to accident victims and their families. So there's a wealth of information and guidance out there that ICAO provides. In the case of Malaysia, this is a Malaysian flagged aircraft, and it took off from Kuala Lumpur. So the Malaysians have the lead for this investigation. There's also, at this point, because we haven't found the aircraft yet, this is a search and rescue effort until we have that investigation.
Go ahead.
We still have a lot to do to find the airplane, and then really the investigation will begin to come together, and more data will come in more quickly once we have the aircraft. There are things that you will still do in the meantime while you're searching for the airplane that will be included as part of that investigation. In a lot of ways, it's as a mariner lost on the sea, other mariners have a moral responsibility to help. And as you know, there are 26 countries now involved in the search and rescue effort. And you talked about the line from the last satellite detection at 8:11 that goes as far north as I think it goes into Kazakhstan, and then comes back down all the way into the southern Indian Ocean, you know, west of Australia. So the Australians are looking in earnest right now in the southern Indian Ocean. Other countries are looking at whatever their radar data may have provided. The United States is, has had the USS Kidd involved, as well as P-8 and P-3 aircraft. There's also Japanese P-3 aircraft participating in the search. So even beyond what's considered the search area, there's a lot of assistance in, involved, and I applaud that effort. I think it's comforting to know that, you know, if something ever happens, that folks are out there looking for you. It's, you know, as you know, it's a vast expanse of ocean and land that this aircraft could potentially be on. And I haven't, you know, decided, you know, I've floated the idea that the airplane could be on land. So it could be in somewhere in the Indian Ocean. It could be somewhere on land. So that there's, as the safety investigation continues, there are things that they should be gathering and in some cases, seizing to make sure no changes are made to them. Those would include like maintenance logs on the airplane to understand what kind of maintenance has been done in the days and weeks prior to the mishap, operations logs for the airplane itself, as well as the crew logs, the dispatcher's information that he provided to the airplane ahead of time, which also includes the flight plan and fuel load. Also the crew history. Now, I've been following the news the last couple of days, and they've seized the simulator that the captain had in his house, which, by the way, was an impressive looking setup. And mm-hmm. they're taking a close look at that.
I think today they're saying the FBI has been called in to basically look at deleted data from the simulator of the at the captain's house.
Right, and I think that there's value from both a safety side and potentially a law enforcement side of an investigation. And those will, like I said, those will happen in parallel. But the FBI are experts at being able to draw that data out, and so there's, you know, they definitely have capability to do that. Just as the NTSB and the FAA have capability to look at radar data.
Mm-hmm.
The radar data is an interesting piece too, because as you try to piece together where this airplane might be, that last fix, if you will, that last location of the airplane becomes more and more important. And
that's the one at 1:30 a.m., the last civilian radar contact, basically, between Malaysia and Vietnam. I take it that you're talking about.
Well, that's the last absolute known one.
Right.
That
they talk about.
Right. You've heard the discussion about primary and secondary radar.
Correct. But why don't you inform our viewer or listeners about this a little bit, just in case people don't understand the different types of signals that are going and coming from this, from a plane or this plane, so to speak.
Well, the crew is talking on a VHF radio to each of the air traffic control sectors as it's proceeding on its route. And, you know, they'll talk to ground, they'll taxi for takeoff, talk to tower, talk to departure control, and then talk to a air traffic control center, which is a controller who covers a large area of airspace. And they're tracking the airplane while it's over land or within radar coverage of land two ways. They're tracking it over a primary radar, which is what you would traditionally think of as a radar, where it sends out an RF radio frequency signal, which bounces off the skin of the airplane and then comes back as an echo return and is displayed on a scope, so you can see a bearing and a range. In some cases, depending on the type of radar, you may be able to see some measure of altitude. And then there's what's known as a secondary radar, which is a interrogation signal that typically follows in that same radar sweeping path. It sends out an interrogation signal which hits every single one of the aircraft that are airborne, and it signals the transponder on board the aircraft to then reply with the code that is set in the transponder, which helps identify the airplane.
So would that be considered the ACARS transmitter then? What is the ACARS transmitter compared to, let's say, putting it in the different radar systems?
Okay, well, the transponder itself just sends a plane's identification and location to air traffic control. It'll send an altitude signal based on a connection between the transponder and the altimeter inside the airplane. But basically, that's all it is a position, code, and an altitude. And the position is really gained by the secondary radar itself that's on the ground. Now, the ACARS is a communication system that lets the home base know how the airplane is functioning, and that will go back to the airline itself. And that's also a way for the pilots to communicate basically via text message back and forth if there are any changes to flight plan or if there's any messages to send to the pilots or pilots to send back to the dispatchers. It also sends information to some of the aircraft manufacturers or subsystem manufacturers. So, for instance, it may send signals from Rolls-Royce. It'll send information to Rolls-Royce and say, here's the current health of the engine, and here's the engine temperature, the engine operating envelope. And so they can even determine, well, this engine is operating at 100% efficiency or 93% efficiency, and it can help them understand when they need to do maintenance on that aircraft, even before it lands at the next destination. So some part of that involves the supply chain of maintaining the airplane as well, and that's part of that information. When airplanes like the 777 are on a long-range flight, they go outside of the normal radar and secondary radar signals, and so they're even beyond VHF or UHF radios. So they're having to communicate either through what's known as a high-frequency radio, HF radio, which is a radio we've used since the last, I think, 80 years. But it can be used to travel long distance, although it's not very high quality. Most airplanes now carry SATCOM equipment, and then that SATCOM equipment may send ACAR signals out. It may send voice communications to and from the airplane. In this case, the ring that you've noticed that from Kazakhstan all the way to the southern Indian Ocean is at a certain angle, what I would call a look angle, to an Inmarsat satellite that's in the Indian Ocean at about 64 degrees east. So that it appears that they're using that satellite to communicate transmissions back and forth, and that's the satellite that at 8:11 a.m. they had the last ping, if you will.
Right. And why do they call it, because I remember reading that they call it a handshake, so that's basically the ping. It just says, hey, I'm here, nice to see you, and on to the next. Was that where the term handshake comes from?
Yeah, well, it's the original setting up of communications back and forth between that satellite and that radio inside the airplane. Back when you had the dial-up and you'd log on to a dial-up internet service provider, you could hear the handshake. Or when you do a fax, you can hear the handshake in between the two fax machines back and forth. And then once that signal's established, they can communicate data back and forth. Well, because there's no data coming from this airplane in this instance, All that it was accomplished was that handshake. So there was no data about the aircraft position or the health of the airplane at that point. And for some reason, that system was not functioning with the satellite, although the satellite radio in the airplane continued to provide that handshake signal for several hours.
Mm-hmm.
What's not known is where those, you know, if there's a satellite detection at 8:11 a.m., was there also a satellite detection at 7:11 a.m. and 6:11 a.m.? And is there any way to identify where those might have been? If you have some semblance of an idea where the radar track was at 2:15 or 2:30 when it had crossed the Malaysian and Thai Peninsula, and if it had gone towards the west, is there any way to see if there's another fix or at least another track that you might be able to draw?
Right.
So it's, again, it's you have very disparate pieces of information, and in many cases you'll get a piece of information through the media that the next day is either refined or even denied by the investigation team. And that's added to a lot of the confusion, and it's also added to a lot of the speculation.
Because I remember hearing that the Thai military that detected this unknown signal, which they thought might be Flight 370, basically that I think came out yesterday, like I said, on Tuesday the 18th of March. And it sort of, the question came up was, why didn't you mention this before? And basically the Thai authorities said no one ever asked, which, you know, it's sort of mind-boggling that people don't want to readily share information. Although there was one speculation that, of course, nations with satellite and detection systems maybe don't want the whole world to know what they can pick up and what they can't pick up for their own security reasons. But let's actually look at, so there's a really good article a couple days on CNN's website that was basically titled 777s Don't Just Disappear. And let's look at that. Like on this point, it's a huge plane. They're new planes. There's very modern technology on them. So it's pretty surprising that this massive technologically advanced plane has in some aspects pretty much just sort of disappeared. So why don't we look into this a little bit and look into it on the basis of the 777 model?
Okay, well, this particular aircraft was a 777-200ER, so it's the model and type of the aircraft. I've got some friends who fly this airplane internationally, and they can't say enough about how pilot-friendly that airplane is and about how safe it is. And you know, as we've talked about, there's an extensive comm suite on board that would provide information just in a normal circumstance, let alone an emergency. There's also, in addition to the other systems we've talked about, there's an emergency locator transmitter on board, which is normally somewhere towards the rear of the airplane. And if the airplane crashes, that's supposed to immediately send a distress signal. And that distress signal is something that we would be able to pick up as sort of a mayday signal, and then you're able to triangulate and find out where that signal is coming from. But once that box goes in the water, that radio signal is no longer visible to the spectrum. So there's also another, as part of that system, there's an underwater system that sends sort of like a knock. It's almost like a key against the glass, kind of a knock that sends a signal in the water, and that signal may last for up to 30 days. So when in the first, I guess it was on the 10th, I began to think that there's a possibility that airplane could be on land someplace, and that was really a thought based on the fact that there had been no emergency locator transmitter signal, because that would be something to me that if even if the plane had they'd landed the plane in the water as smoothly as they possibly could, you would still should still have that signal just based on the deceleration of the airplane as it settled into the water. And there has been no sighting of positive sighting of wreckage at this point. So I began to wonder if that was maybe a possibility. And that's obviously some people are discussing that now, but you can't really say for sure that that piece of gear was operational. And there's even I don't know about Malaysian airline standards, but there are some minimum equipment list standards that allow you to operate the airplane even if the ELT, the emergency locator transmitter, is inoperative. So I'm not sure that you can do that with passengers, but I've read somewhere that that was possible. But I don't know, if they've looked into maintenance records and determined that it was up or when the last time it was tested or whatever, and that would be part of an investigation as well. So there's, again, we talk about these little pieces of information and you can't put them all together. And some things don't make sense in some scenarios and they make total sense in other scenarios.
And say that this plane was diverted from its original flight path and taken somewhere and actually landed. I mean, this is a very big plane. I mean, there's 239 people on board. I mean, you need a vast expanse of land to land this. I mean, how easy would that be looking at the territory where it is actually overland, looking at the terrain from all the way up to Kazakhstan? I mean, is how viable is that theory?
The further you talk about that airplane flying and that far and across that expanse of land, I think that you have a lower and lower probability of that happening from a number of different perspectives. But one of them is just that there aren't that many places you can land a 777. I think you could technically land a 777 if it was towards the light end of its fuel load. On runways as maybe as short as 6,000 or 7,000 feet, it'd be very difficult to get the airplane airborne again. But you could potentially land it. But normally, these airplanes are flying from runways that are 11,000, 12,000, 13,000 feet long, so that you have a certain limit on where you could put the plane down. You also have any airport, you have a lot of people looking, so it's not like you can hide a 777. There's not that many hangars that are big enough, and you're not just going to like pull it in to some international airport and park it in a hangar. So I think that's a very difficult thing to do. And then most places where they have an international airport, they also have cell phone coverage. So you would think that someone would have been able to make a cell phone call. Just as you fly in the United States and you land, everybody's got their cell phones out and they're making calls before the plane gets off the runway. So I would think that there's a lot of things that go into that would be very difficult. Also, the detection of the country's own international radar systems as you go up. I mean, India's got good capability with the radars. China does as well. So you have a number of different countries that would probably see an airplane that is not squawking, as we say, the transponder. When you use the transponder, it's called squawking. So you'd see an airplane that's not squawking, it's flying in that airspace, and you would challenge that airplane. And you would think that at some point someone would have said, well, we challenged an airplane for 2 hours that was coming across our airspace, but no one has said that at this point. And there's also been speculation that someone can, they talk about trying to fly below the radar. Well, I'll tell you, if you're flying this airplane in the middle of the night, you're not flying below anybody's radar, especially in the terrain that we're talking about as you follow that arc up towards Kazakhstan. You know, the terrain is just incredibly mountainous, and it would be impossible, even if you had night vision goggles, to be able to fly in terrain like that with an airplane like the 777. So,
and when they say, because I've heard this theory about maybe the plane having intentionally slipped past the radar and flying below radar. I mean, what is the level that the plane would have to fly through to basically slip past radar? Is there a certain
there's not really kind of feet or there's not really a certain altitude, but
right.
It really depends on your proximity to a radar station, the terrain around that radar station. It'd be, like I said, it would be almost impossible for you to do it. You think about the airplanes that we fly in the military, and you know, even those type airplanes would be very difficult to fly below the radar, and especially at night in that type of terrain.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, why don't we talk about the flight programming? Because, of course, there's this theory or evidence, should I say, that's come out that right before the last verbal transmission from the plane, that someone intentionally changed the flight path program on flight 370. So, I mean, what are the reasons that someone might change a flight path? Because as far as I've been reading, it's not, there could be other reasons. It could be pre-programming the plane in case of an emergency to head back towards where it has taken off. You know, maybe not changing the flight program's path is not always an intentional act of malice, let's put it that way. So let's look at the different reasons why a flight program might be changed.
Well, as I mentioned, the dispatcher will actually put the flight plan in, and it's been said, I think, in the news last day or two that the dispatcher put the flight plan in from Kuala Lumpur up to Beijing as planned. There could be a lot of reasons you would change that flight plan in flight. It could be at air traffic control's direction because of traffic. They may want you to take a different route around traffic. Because of weather, you may ask for deviation left or right of course so that you can get around a thunderstorm. If there's an emergency, you may put a change in flight plan to get you to the nearest airport. And in some systems, there's basically a button that says nearest airport and allows you to immediately start the plane, the navigation system at least, headed towards that. And now these navigation systems are coupled with the autopilot in a lot of cases, and a lot of times the pilot will fly with the autopilot and allow the autopilot to make the turn once the flight plan has been entered. There was one theory that came out yesterday on the 18th by Chris Goodfellow that said that it could be as simple as a catastrophic fire on board the aircraft, mm-hmm. and that they could have begun to have the symptoms of a fire and started making changes in course to get to where they needed to go. There's of all the theories that have come out, this is Chris is a pilot himself, he's got a pretty interesting theory, and it's not something that I would discount too quickly. And I talk about what I would do in an emergency like this. I had an instructor pilot tell me once, whenever you have an emergency, the first thing you should do is wind the clock. And what he meant by that is that you should take a deep breath and try to decide what your next step should be. You should not be making fast movements in the cockpit. You should not be suddenly turning the airplane in different directions. But you might start to plan on what you're going to do as you go through this emergency procedure. If there was something like an emergency in the airplane, you might put in a waypoint that was either the nearest airfield or something. If you had a lot of experience in that area, you might even put an initial approach fix that takes you towards a path to land at that airport. So you might enter that either as a standby waypoint, or you may enter it right away and have the autopilot disengaged, ready to engage it later, and have the airplane point in that direction. So there's a, you know, the discussion about when, and I'm not sure how they understand that these keystrokes were made. There's a discussion about exact time of when that was made. I tend to question, like I said, I tend to question each piece of information. So I don't necessarily want to think that there's a, until the other pieces come together, that there's necessarily a specific date timestamp there that we can rely on. And remember where this airplane was. It was in the either established on at cruise altitude and about to change from the Malaysia flight information region into the Vietnam flight information region. So they're going to switch from one controller to another. And typically what will happen is you'll have the controllers talking to each other. They'll say, I've got Malaysia 370 headed your way. He's at flight level 300, which means he's at 30,000 feet. He's squawking this code. And so they'll pass that information through either automatically or over the phone. And they'll do the radio handoff. They'll tell the Malaysian airplane it's time to switch to Vietnam on this frequency. And they'll acknowledge that frequency and then transition over the next frequency. Now, in this case, as you said before, they said, what was the exact quote was,
all right, good night.
All right, good night. I've said this on Twitter that it would not be unusual for me to say something along those lines at the end of a radio call, where I may say something along the lines of Malaysia 370 switch in Vietnam blank to blank frequency. All right, good night. I might say, take care. But usually it's something, if I know that I'm switching for the night and I'm not going to be coming back, I may say goodnight. I don't think there's a lot to be read into that piece of data by itself either.
Right. I mean, basically when he says all right, it's not A-L-R-I-G-H-T, it's A-L-L and then R-I-G-H-T. So it's basically like all right, which could mean a lot of things as well. I mean, I'm not going to speculate into any of that. I mean, but it seems like you said that this last transmission was at that crucial point where you're switching from Malaysia airspace to Vietnam airspace.
Yeah, and if I said that the timing may not be a specific timestamp, there also may be things taking place inside the cockpit in those minutes between when they're putting in information into the navigation flight plan to change a waypoint and that radio call, where they may be sensing the beginning of something being wrong. They may have something as simple as, hey, do you smell something weird? Just in case, I'm going to put this data point in the box. Okay, roger that. You start putting the data point in the box. And then if things progress and get worse, then you're going to have to take action. So it could be that they were still evaluating a situation that was either just starting or getting worse at the point where he made that last radio call. We're not going to know that. We may not even know that when we find the airplane, because the cockpit voice recorder, if the plane continued to fly as long as we think it did, it will have recorded over that section anyway. But we may be able to piece back some of the data from the airplane itself. Now, Chris has talked about an electrical fire and procedures that you would do under in that kind of a condition would involve securing different electrical buses so that you're isolating possible sources of fire. In an electrical fire in an airplane, the biggest worry is the smoke that can develop from burning electrical wires or burning electrical equipment. And that smoke can both incapacitate from breathing it in, and it could also cause you to lose the ability to see, because some of the acrid smoke could actually hurt your eyes. So if something like that were to take place, part of that step of assessing what it is, maybe while you're thinking about that, to break out that book and see what the emergency procedures are, and to start setting yourself up for what's going to take place after that. Again, like I said before, when something happens, you wind the clock. So he may have been thinking about, what am I going to do? What are my next steps going to be? And then in that time, the fire could have progressed, and it could have already either caused a radio equipment to fail, or they may have decided to take steps to isolate equipment and have secured buses that affected some of the communications equipment. I've heard different things about what circuit breakers they have to pull and where those circuit breakers are. In that kind of situation, I don't think anybody's getting out of the cockpit, but who knows I'm not sure what the procedures would be, but from what I understand, everything can be done from within inside the cockpit. Also, they've talked about that turn itself, whether it was on autopilot when it made that turn. If I call autopilot George, and if George is flying the airplane just fine, and I'm going through an emergency procedure, I'll let George make that turn while I'm reading through the book with my co-pilot and think through the steps that we would take in that emergency. So if I have to secure generators, if I have to pull circuit breakers, we could talk about that through the checklist, step by step, using a challenge reply method. And there may be times where I have to look at a circuit breaker that's up over my head. And remember, too, you have a pilot, the captain of the airplane, had almost 20,000 hours, which is an incredible amount of flight time.
Very experienced, yes.
Yeah, very experienced. Even, a plane's probably got a lot of hours flying long distances, but, regardless, that's still, if you count that in years airborne, that's probably like 12 years airborne or something ridiculous. The co-pilot had about 2,000 hours, which in comparison is not a lot of flight time. I'm not sure how many hours in type that he had. It could be 2,000, it could be less. There's a little bit of a difference in gradient and experience, and sometimes that interaction between the pilot and the co-pilot can lead to different dynamics in a cockpit. So you might have, and I even saw this in myself when I was a commanding officer, is when I'm having an emergency in the airplane, I may be paying a lot closer to attention to what specific actions my co-pilot's taking than I probably should. So he could have been, they could have both had their heads up and needed to have George flying the airplane through the turn while they're deciding what circuit breakers on the overhead panel to pull.
If you look at the practical aspect of the turn, I know that now they're looking at more into a, what if this was intentionally turned for a malicious purpose? But if you look at the practical aspect, it's turning back towards land. They're over water when this last contact with the plane happened. So, if you look at it that way, it makes a lot of sense that if there is something going on board, that is an emergency. And like you said, if it's on autopilot and George is flying the plane, it's going back towards land, which does make sense, at least in my mind. At this point, is Malaysia the main country that has the full right involvement in the investigation until maybe any other traces of the actual plane being in another country? I know there's these ideas that it flew over different airspace for different countries, but I know that there are a number of countries involved in the search, but who is the main responsible country for the investigation? Would it be Malaysia, since it's a Malaysian flight?
Yeah, the investigation will stay with Malaysia throughout, because it was a Malaysian flagged airplane. Right. Okay. They will have the responsibility for the investigation. Now, if it's, let's say it's found in another country, or found in territorial waters of another country, they will assist with any kind of a rescue or salvage operation, and they will make sure that they have folks from the investigation team present as they make decisions about how they're going to salvage different parts of the airplane. Because once you've transitioned from a search and rescue into a salvage operation, it becomes part of the investigation. You want to make sure that you're not disturbing certain pieces. So you'll have help from a host country, but it'll still be the it'll still fall under Malaysia's responsibility to investigate. Now they can pull upon, they can bring folks in from that country if they want to as part of the investigation team. They can bring folks in from the United States that may have certain expertise in certain areas. They can bring folks in from China. They can bring representatives from the aircraft manufacturer or the subsystem manufacturers as they find certain things that they would need to explore in more detail. And as you know, as you started, a lot of this is covered in the ICAO Annex 13. But you would want to make sure that you had the right expertise helping you throughout any investigation. So, you know, we knew who, if we had mishap either on the ship or within our air wing or with our own squadron, we knew who to reach out to for specific help. We basically had a whole list of from everything from if I need to answer a question about this type of engine to I need to identify this specific species of bird that the airplane hit. We had basically a whole pre-mishap plan that was allow us to do that. And so you don't really find out how good or bad your pre-mishap plan is until something like this happens. And I think there'll be a lot of lessons learned from Malaysia, but also I think that you've seen in the last couple of days that Malaysia's been increasingly willing to bring expertise on board and to allow others to help as needed throughout the investigation. I think that will only get better with time as they learn as they go along in some cases. Every single accident investigation is different, and of course this one is far, far different than anything we've ever seen before.
Yeah, it's very mind-boggling, and like you said, there's information from the investigation, but it's so much of bits and pieces where it's just mind-boggling that this plane has basically disappeared. Mm-hmm. Coming to the end of the show, we like to always give our guests a moment to maybe make a point that we haven't talked about, or if there is another aspect that you'd like to present. So I'm going to hand the floor over to you.
Well, I think that there's something that's been part of this that's happened throughout has been both the media coverage, and it's been interesting to watch some of the media coverage, both in TV and print. CNN has kind of gone, I don't know if you would call it overboard, but they've basically focused every bit of effort and time on having folks talk about the accident itself and different possibilities of what could happen. The media coverage was probably overwhelming the actual information that's coming out of the investigation. And if you're doing an accident investigation, you want to release information that is both relevant and factual as it goes along. I think that the time cycle between the United States and Malaysia has also added a dimension to this too, because it miraculously seems to line up with a press conference that'll happen in the morning in Malaysia, which is primetime television in the United States. So then you have, you know, the breaking news and the overreaction to pieces of information that come out. You have four or five guys talking about that. That you know may or may not have real insight to what's going on. There's also cultural difference at play too. Our media tends to be aggressive and ask a lot of tough questions, and I'm not sure that folks there are used to those kind of questions. And then you have the families that are there on site as well, so that you know the authorities there have to be concerned about the families, and you see that the stress levels of the families are only increasing as the days go on. The time, because there's been so little to really say this definitely happened or this didn't happen, as time goes on, we're only going to have more and more speculation. When that airplane is finally found, that's really going to, as you know, obviously is going to dramatically limit what the speculation is. It'll be a pretty quick understanding of how far the plane flew, what type of thing may happen. But we may not know the real cause of this accident for several months, especially if the airplane is at the bottom of the southern Indian Ocean. The Australians right now are putting a strong effort to look at that part of the southern Indian Ocean. That's over the next couple of days. I think folks should pay attention to the search operations that are going on down there and who's participating in that as well. If they do identify the location, they're going to then have to salvage out the different pieces that will help them identify what happened with the airplane. And in the Air France mishap, there was about 13,000 feet of water or something crazy like that that they had to endure to find that. Also, there's all those pieces of speculation. If there's this theory that called Bayesian, I guess Bayesian statistics or Bayesian insight, that if you look at a probability of a particular hypothesis and you put all the information that you know together, you can learn what that probability of that particular hypothesis is happening. So you might be able to say, let's stick with the hypothesis that the plane is somewhere along that arc down in the southern Indian Ocean. You'd be able to put together the pieces of information that you know now, and as that changes, you may see the probability of that increase or decrease dramatically. And you can also change that hypothesis as you go along. That's something that they used in the Air France accident, and also used on a fairly regular basis, I believe, in the Coast Guard to actually locate people when they've need to be rescued. So there's some mathematical theories that you can use to help locate that airplane. Now, in the case of Air France, you're talking about an area that was significantly smaller than what we're looking at now, with significantly fewer potential hypotheses of what could have happened to the airplane. So in this environment, it's a lot more complex, but I still think you could apply those same techniques, and you'd also need to keep an open mind to several different potential theories of our hypotheses of what could have happened.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show, Herb, and talking about this difficult subject. And just out of my own heart, I just want to send my well wishes to the families, because it's hell that they're going through. And call me naive, but I really, really hope that miraculously maybe this plane is found and that everybody on board is okay. So sending prayers in that direction. But thank you for coming on the show and giving your fantastic expertise from all of your flying experience.
Well, Chelsea, thanks for having me on. And hopefully, like we said before, by the time this is posted online, we'll already know what happened to the airplane. And hopefully, as you say, things will turn out well for the families. This is, I can't imagine what it would be like to have somebody on board this airplane that I know and love. It must be heart-wrenching to the folks that are waiting right now.
Yeah, very much so. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and thank you to our listeners for listening, and we'll have other Loopcast shows coming up, so keep aware for those. Thank you.